problems which you and Ben were talking. In the 90s, race and murder were the trend. The only way this nation can even hope to last this decade is for God and America.
The only hope for America is you. The only hope for our country is you.
Good evening, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for a time. In fact, hold your calls until we ask for calls, because now we're going to be interviewing Michael Heisner this evening, and he's written a fascinating book called The Facade, and with the caption, "Most people don't really want to know the truth. They're just looking for the answers that confirm their prejudices." Now, Michael Heisner is a very interesting individual. He's currently working for his PhD in Hebrew, Bible, and Ancient Semitic Languages at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. He holds an MA in Ancient History from the University of Pennsylvania. And, of course, he's gone into the major fields of ancient Israel Egyptology, and he has an MA from the University of Wisconsin in Madison in Hebrew, Bible, and Ancient Semitic Languages. He's a recipient of a number of various awards. He actually went to Bob Jones University, but he is also very interested in the UFO phenomenon, and the book he's writing is written about, of course, the things that most people don't even like to address, and that is that there really is something out there that affects every one of our lives, and, of course, it fits into the spiritual realm. Michael, thank you so very much for being with us this evening.
Thank you for having me on.
All right, fine. Well, why don't you just talk a little bit about it? Shall we talk about the book specifically and the plot of the book? Because
sure.
It starts out really, it's one of these books that grabs you the first page. There's a mystery out there, people are being abducted and taken to a secret meeting place, a secret place where a group of 11 people are going to address a problem that affects the entire world. And, of course, it's really run by a group that nobody really understands, but all we know is it's called a group. There is somebody that is far more powerful than the president, far more powerful than the Congress, somebody out there that really is directing the course of our society. And, of course, most people don't really care as long as good times continue rolling. And, of course, here is the situation that challenges and really will disrupt the entire world. So why don't you sort of pick up the story from there?
Well, the focus of the book initially is I wanted to address the question of what would be the impact on mainstream Christianity and conservative Judaism if something were to happen where I'm trying to recover the phrases that you used in your opening about reality and illusion, but if the reality was in fact that there was an intelligent extraterrestrial presence out there somewhere that was known, the government knew about, and all of a sudden had to reveal, had to confirm, what would the impact be on Christianity and Judaism? And so the main character is sort of confronted with this question initially, and unbeknownst to him, he can't see any ostensible reason why he was chosen or why he was taken to this location. He's pretty much got no life, and he seems completely out of place, but he finds out that a friend of his past is connected to this, and they're both believers, and the person who has him brought to this location really needs his input, because they've often talked about this question, and the person who's brought him to this location is now actually confronted with this. This is a person that is in the government, is in a position to know, and really needs this other guy to help him think through the impact of what is looming ahead, and that is an extraterrestrial revelation. So that's where the book really focuses initially.
All right, fine. But, of course, you weave this wonderful, wonderful story. You're an excellent writer, and, the way you sort of throw in these little things very, very soon after the book begins, we cut away from the major characters to a gentleman who's sitting in a room, and he's obviously making some remarks that are unpleasant to the man he's talking to, and the remarks are something, well, obviously, we won't need you anymore.
Yeah, we won't need you. You failed us for the last time.
You failed us for the last time. And, of course, this episode where the assassin comes in and kills this man. And then, of course, he turns and walks through the wall behind him. Mm-hmm. And, of course, that it wasn't just walked up to the wall or walked through a door in the wall behind him, but walk through, and just this casual little phrase catch your attention, and you begin to realize you're dealing with something that is beyond the pale of the physical in which we live today. And
right.
Of course, from my point of view, I've been to the Georgia Guidestones and seen those strange monuments there that obviously built by somebody that no one knows who put them up there. I've talked to people within the Central Intelligence Agency who said, yes, we know there is a program for worldwide population control. This information came across my desk when I was a station chief for the CIA. There are forces out there that most people are totally, totally unfamiliar with it. I mean, you tell them about something like the talk group, you talk about the group. Do you want to develop at all the concept of the group? Because
sure.
They're the ones who are behind the project.
Yeah, well, most people, I mean, my general theme is that what passes for the UFO and alien phenomenon today is nothing but a facade. It masks a greater reality, and that is an occult reality. That we are, what we're witnessing is something that goes all the way back to ancient times, but really in the public consciousness, if anyone actually does any reading on UFOs, it's really the late 1800s when the subject really gets talked about. But my position is that it is a facade. It's just a manifestation. It's an occult manifestation of a greater spiritual reality that goes very, very far back into ancient times, just a sort of a new way of displaying itself as our technological saviors. And it is evil, it is sinister, it is satanic, but most people don't even really think about this. And I write a newsletter for readers of The Facade, and this month, one of the books that's reviewed in the newsletter is something called UFOs and the National Security State. And it is the single best book, I think, for handing to someone who is a skeptic, who doesn't believe there's a government behind a government and just thinks this is ridiculous, for demonstrating to them that no, you are living the illusion. I'm not living the illusion. But you are, because the book, this one I'm referring to, started out as a PhD dissertation by a gentleman who was researching Harry Truman's national security policy. And you, having read the book, you know that the Truman era, the late 40s and early 50s, is when in our country that the whole UFO phenomenon really exploded on the scene. And this is essentially a dissertation-level book. Does nothing but go through primary documents, internal memos, and so on and so forth, and documents the fact that this has been a major concern of the United States for a long time, a national security concern, and that there were very few people who really knew what was going on. And you know, to this day, those people more or less inherit their positions. They're independent of elected authority. And I think that maybe some of those people do know that what they're dealing with is a satanic phenomenon. Other people don't, maybe don't care. They think they're on the right side and they can survive. But the whole idea of a group is the perpetuation of this little cabal of people who really have a very deliberate agenda to cooperate with these powers in our society, and as they work their will, they conspire together to ensure that they think their own survival, but in the end they don't.
And I think that this is such a ridiculous concept to somebody who doesn't understand what's going on, but you're absolutely right, of course. This whole UFO phenomenon, you know, is to confuse people. In other words, yes, there is something there. And, of course, there really are cattle mutilations, but they're not being done by little critters from outer space. But there are little critters there. It's just that they're not, I don't believe they're manifestations of a extraterrestrial entity. But the trouble is, they focus our attention on that. Oh, that's a government cover-up. They don't want you to know about these, that the Greys have been visiting us, or that, you know, they have an alliance with our leaders. That was sort of the theme of the X-Files. And it was done just very, very beautifully. You were never quite certain what it was,
right,
you know, until about the fifth year, when they finally revealed, yes, there really are extraterrestrials, and our leaders have made a pact with them. Well, of course, I think our leaders have made a pact truly with the devil.
Yeah, that's the perspective I take. I mean, I'm an academic, and so when I've always been interested in paranormal subjects, but really intensely only since 1997. But I determined when I sort of got into this that I wasn't going to read anything that wasn't by someone who had credentials. And in the book, I really try to stick close to, again, you know, if you're going to talk about government documents and government conspiracies, you know, what are your credentials? Well, you know, this guy has a PhD in history or whatever, and he's an expert on Truman's national security. You know, another guy, you know, who's into abductions, you know, teaches at Harvard. I don't agree with his positions, but he recognizes it as a spiritual phenomenon.
Is a fellow who's actually cataloged all the alien abductions.
Yeah, right. John Mack at Harvard and David Jacobs at Temple. Now, they don't necessarily agree with each other. David Jacobs is a history professor at Temple who wrote a book called The Threat. He's actually written three or four books related to UFOs. He's convinced that there are little genuine interplanetary little beings that are coming here and abducting our women and having their way with them. And he's frankly scared. And I don't know how to, you know, you write a book called The Threat. It kind of tells you where he's at. But these are mainstream academics that have been into this for decades, and they're not lunatics. They're saying, look, something really is happening to these people. But I think they're choosing to believe the facade.
Well, because, of course, the only other alternative would be that there is a God and
right, there's a greater spiritual reality.
Right,
sure.
And of course, since they cannot accept that. But, you know, I could see why they'd be scared to death. If I didn't, you know the Lord, I'd be scared to death, too, knowing what I know. And I'm sure you would be as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it does give you a sense of helplessness. And the real cosmic villains in the facade are the fallen sons of God of the Old Testament, known elsewhere as the Watchers in Middle Judaism, Middle Jewish text, which is where I'm doing my dissertation. So, you know, the Watchers have been, the goal has always been the same, to solicit worship from humanity that doesn't belong to them. And in the Book of Enoch, for instance, we're told that the Watchers, of course, do the Genesis 6 thing with our women. They dole out high technology for the specific purpose of that mankind might look at them as gods. And in the same way, we have this assumed extraterrestrial presence. And if you read abduction literature, people, again, professionals that counsel these people and try to make sense of this without a biblical worldview, the stuff that the ETs say to them is right along these lines, that they have the answers to our environmental problems, they have the answers to our spiritual evolution. We can help you save the planet, but you're just not quite enlightened enough, blah, 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 so on and so forth. And I think that we're going through a cultural acclimation, a very systematic prepping by spiritual forces cooperating with human forces to get us to accept this idea that there is an ET reality, and not only that, but that there are saviors. And I think this is the facade, which is why in the book I maneuver things to the point where it becomes very obvious that the only people who are going to object to this vaulting, the next stage of human evolution, is essentially born again Christians and Orthodox Jews who are just not going to have any of this. They're not going to have anything to do with this, and they will become the targets. And what's really scary, the view I take of the whole Roswell incident, that this was a paperclip experiment gone awry. Most people don't even know about paperclip.
Well, why don't you tell our listeners about paperclip? Because it's such an important part of our history, and yet, of course, to those who do not read this sort of thing, they say this couldn't be true because Barbara Walters would have told us. But
yeah.
You explain to our listeners what paperclip was, and because there's so many books out there, so much documentation on it, and yet, of course, it's literally unknown to the average American. But then the average American, is educated far beyond his intelligence.
Yeah, around the early to mid-80s is when a lot of the publishing about paperclip started. Paperclip was our government's program during the last couple of years of World War II and thereafter to recruit Nazi scientists and bring them into this country so that we could essentially pick their brains and use their technological expertise, sanitize their lives and their dossiers and make them U.S. citizens. And if you're Wernher von Braun, you get to be the number two guy eventually at NASA and host of Walt Disney's World of Tomorrow. People just didn't even know that Wernher von Braun was, in fact, a Nazi. The last issue of my newsletter, I posted part of his FBI file where, the government, people within the government knew this, but deliberately under Truman's nose. Truman had originally approved paperclip, but with the caveat that anyone who was directly linked to the Nazi Party, we don't want to bring them over. But people began to realize that we're missing a lot of these scientists and the Russians are getting them. It was a Cold War mentality. And so the paperclip was that if they saw the file of a guy who they wanted, and even though he was a member of the Nazi Party, they would put a paperclip on his file, and that was a sign to the next person down the bureaucratic line that this is somebody we need to clean up their file and bring them into the country, unbeknownst to the president. So paperclip is a classic government within a government operation that now is widespread public knowledge if people care to actually read about the era. This isn't conspiracy theory, it's conspiracy fact.
In fact, we're actually carrying a book now. It's called Gestapo Chief. It's the story of Heinrich Mueller, who was the head of Hitler's Gestapo. And, of course, we're all familiar with that fellow with the overcoat and the hat who says, let me see your papers,
Yeah, sure.
Actually, Heinrich Mueller, who headed the Gestapo, was brought to America and given a plush job and lived in Piedmont in Oakland, just adjacent to Oakland until he died in 1983. Mm-hmm. The American public is incapable of understanding that we're really not anti-Nazi. We helped them to, actually many of them, go to South America. We brought those we needed here, and we brought the head of the Gestapo here to the United States. So you have to understand that things are never as they appear to be. And that's the great tragedy. And, of course, that's what you're really bringing out, that there is this government within a government that really runs things. And if anybody doesn't understand that, why, of course, they really can't understand what's going on today.
Sure. And when we and the British bombed Peenemünde, one of the secret skunk work operations of the Nazis, I mean, there's a famous book on Nazi aerial technology and essentially flying saucer technology that British intelligence produced that I quote in The Facade. You know, I have this little line, and it's not just marketing, it's true. It's that nothing in, everything in the book, is genuine. You know, that every quote, every ancient text, everything is absolutely real. It's only the connections, that make up the story, but all the data points are real.
Now, let me just read what you said.
Sure.
Every person referred to herein, except for the characters, are real. Every quotation attributed to such persons is genuine. Every technology noted is operational. Only the applications remain uncertain. Every formally classified top secret document referred to and reproduced herein actually exists. Every ancient text discussed by the characters is authentic. Every point of exegesis is backed by solid biblical scholarship and in no way contrived, which means that nothing in this book is true, but is exactly the way things really are and will be. That's beautifully put. That's in the foreword of the book. And I think
that is the case.
And I think for our listeners, I mean, this is a gripping novel. It's written in novel form. And yet, of course, as you get into this, you begin realizing that the author is telling what's really going on today in fictional form, because the story is so incredible that most people are unable to accept reality. And we see the crop circles. I mean, and then they try to convince us, oh, this is just a bunch of guys running
right.
around in a field,
yeah.
you know,
Duncan
with a
Dave.
Rope so that they can make a perfect circle. These cattle mutilations. Well, this may be a satanic cult or something out there.
A carnivorous mouse, that's
right.
The latest one.
it's sort of like, there's so many things that go on that are said, and somebody once said, it doesn't matter how ridiculous something is, if you say it often enough and convincingly enough, people will really believe. And they
the
don't
argument from authority.
And they really don't understand that there is a world that we live in, and then there's a spiritual world.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, people ask me about, conspiracies. Well, you do believe in conspiracies. It floors me that if you believe in evil, if you believe in the devil, if you believe in an evil hierarchy that of the kind that's revealed in the New Testament, the principalities and powers, and there are lots of other Greek and Hebrew terms behind all this, but if you say you believe this, then all of the conspiracy is that these beings are acting in concert to their own self-interest and using people to accomplish a preconceived end. But it seems to me that of all people who should embrace this idea, it should be Christians, and those are the ones that just seem the most incredulous over a spiritual reality. And my own academic specialty is divine and angelic beings in Semitic texts, and I live in this world, where I see, things going on in the text, and as a believer, this is a no-brainer. To me. But then when you get out and you go to a convention or you get invited to speak here or there, people, I don't want to think. I've actually had people tell me, I just don't want to think about this.
Well, really, of course, first of all, if you don't believe in God, you can't face this reality that this could really be real. If you do believe in God, unfortunately, I think that the purpose of what goes on in our churches today is it draws away from the truth. I really believe that they've changed the message of the gospel and they've changed the music of the church, and we are seeing the great apostasy today that was foretold several thousand years ago.
The Facade is actually the first of what I imagine will be a series of four or five. And that this is the facade, and the rest of the books are going to get really into the agenda. What is behind the facade that is actually going on? And I can tell you without giving away too much that where I'm leading is I'm leading to something that I think will trigger the apostasy, that all of this is designed, and I do take it seriously, both exegetically and from a Semitic scholar's viewpoint and just as a believer, I take it seriously. But I think that we are being set up so that our own theology will be used against us to crush the will of the church, because I tend to think that a lot of things are going to happen in the future. Prophecies will get fulfilled in such a way that it'll be like the first coming. You know, it'll happen in a way that people aren't expecting, and that this was in the text, but we never really looked closely at it, or we just accepted one particular interpretation, and it was a comfortable one. But lo and behold, here we are. You know, we find ourselves confronting not just, you know, people in the future, but interaction with, as Paul puts it, spiritual wickedness in high places. And the facade is the setup for all of this. But people just don't want to believe it. I mean, I could show people a schematic drawing of a flying saucer that came out of Nazi Germany and said, look, you know, this is what they were working on. I think they just brought this over here and were on our payroll. And what happened at Roswell was an experiment. Here it is. They used, you know, undesirables, human children, perhaps with Down syndrome. I have a drawing on my website of he just died last year, but the last remaining survivor who claimed to have seen the bodies at Roswell, he was a trained sketch artist. They don't look anything like the Grays. They look like little kids. They look like bald kids with Down syndrome. And what I'm claiming is that the Nazis just did what they did any other time, and they were on our payroll. And the thing to cover up is that, and the extraterrestrial hypothesis was just very convenient. It created an alternative mythology that people have just bought into.
And I don't think there's no question at all that the Germans had developed flying saucers.
Oh, sure.
And these people, and I think the Soviets got one, and we got all the plans for them, and there's no question that we developed these things. But of course,
we would have been crazy not to.
But, of course, the question is, you know, why are the American people so gullible that they can't understand that there is an organized program of disinformation to confuse them that is being put forward by the government?
Because isn't it amazing?
There really are forces that work behind the scenes, but in my estimation, many times these forces are really influenced by evil. Well, our telephone number, if you'd like to give us a call, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Michael, how can people get hold of your book? How can they get hold of your newsletter? It sounds really fascinating to me.
Well, the website, you know, I have two websites. One is www.facadenovel.com, and the other one is www.michaelsheiser.com, and that's Michael with an S and then Heiser. And I decided for your program to run a special to anybody who subscribes to the newsletter.
You can't give a price because this is a non-commercial station,
okay.
But go ahead and
let
them know there's a special anyway.
Right. There is, right? You can. I have written two other books, one on the Bible code and another one on Islam's role in prophecy. And if they go to the websites, I'm basically giving, you know, one or two of those away, depending on what people, you know, are interested in and what they want to purchase. But the newsletter is explained on the websites, and basically that is the nonfiction academic stuff and the contemporary news items that relate to things that happen in the book, in the facade. So it's sort of the nonfiction vehicle to keep people up to date and to take them through some of the ideas that are in the book.
Well, you know, sometimes it's very hard to write just a regular factual book and hold people's attention until they'll read it through to the very end.
Sure.
In your novel, you can barely wait to get to the end. In fact, I can hardly wait for the next one to come along. You know, because it's really gripping. And there's always this question, I mean, what is this about? I mean, and it draws you into it very, very well, because you know there's something there, but what is it? And certainly I hope that many non-Christians will read this book because, of course, hopefully, and I'm sure you hope as well, that, you know, they'll begin looking beyond the obvious for the spiritual explanation of what's going on today.
I was just invited, I spoke there on July 13th, to the to Houston to the meeting of a group called HUFON, Houston UFO Network, and I actually had somebody after the meeting tell me that they decided to become a believer because of the book.
Well, you know,
which was great.
Well, that's really what it's really all about, because what we're doing is hopefully God's work, and the benefit we really won't know until eternity. But if we can touch somebody's life with what we do, then our lives really become worthwhile. All right, well, we're going to have to take a break here at this time. We have a 3-minute break. And, of course, when we get back, we'll welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. And, of course, here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Our guest this evening is Michael Heisner. His book is called The Facade, and it's got this face of a gray on the front of it. It it just catches your attention. It's a beautiful, beautiful cover. It gets your attention. You realize that there's something there. But of course, anybody who is not a fool realizes that there's something out there. And of course, but what is that truth? Well, of course, we're going to be getting into that more during the next half hour. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. If you're out there listening to us across America, here in the Central Coast of California, up there in the Great Northwest, well, we hope that many of you will decide that you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family and help us do what we do 5 hours a day, and then, of course, on two programs on the weekend, as we try to reach out to make people understand that we're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of mankind. It's being fought on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield, but it is a battle, and we're involved in it whether we want to be or not, because unfortunately the status quo is not going to continue to exist. We are moving into the most difficult times of your life in the next several years, and we're going to see cataclysmic changes, I think, as far as the structure of society, as far as our economics are concerned, as far as the increasing tempo of violence, and you better be prepared for it. And, of course, the greatest preparation at all is the fact that you now have a personal relationship with the Lord. But over and above that, you're going to have to do all the things that logical people would do, and I believe that we are called to do, to look after ourselves and our families, and then after that, of course, putting our ultimate faith in Him to whom we owe our allegiance. So, of course, we feel that what we do is try to touch people's lives through the radio. And we have a unique opportunity that's been given to us. It sort of happened, but I do not believe that it's anything that I did that has created what we have today, but we do have an outreach across America, really across the world, through the miracle of electronics. And if you'd like to be part of our team and help us, and especially so we can expand into the new markets where we would hope to reach more and more and more people, why give us a call. 464-8295, that's 464-8295, or actually the number you would call would be 1-800-544-8927, that's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and if you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, why, of course, we'd be glad to send you one, the June and the July newsletter. I deal with the fact that the government, for perhaps stupidity or perhaps for some other reason, allowed, first of all, a cancer virus to be put in the first polio vaccine, and then monkey cytomegalic viruses produce progressive degenerative diseases in the second polio vaccine. And, of course, it almost seems impossible that these highly placed and highly paid scientists could be as stupid as they have been and contaminated the human race with all sorts of foreign viruses. But be that as it may, you're going to read things in my June and July newsletter you will never read any other place. And, of course, all we need to do is look and see that 1 in 12 children now has a handicap of one form or another. They may be mild, but some of them are terribly devastating. The incidence of autism has increased some 600% in the last 20 years, and nobody knows why. Well, maybe when you read my newsletters, you will know why. But you need to get the newsletters. You need to, and you can get them off the internet for that matter. You need to copy them. You need to give them to people. You need to get them to read them. Because people aren't going to begin looking for answers until they know there's a problem. And hopefully after they've read a problem, after they've read the letters and read some of the other things we have, they'll realize the true nature of the problem we face. So again, remember the number 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Because we are at war. America is under siege today. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and my guest this evening is Michael Heisner, his book, The Facade. And it's a fascinating, fast-moving adventure story that starts out with this young man. His name is Brian Scott, Dr. Brian Scott. He's he is sort of a prototype of the author. He is a scholar, a scholar in ancient biblical languages, and he is literally kidnapped by two ruffians who have been sent there, who very politely tell him that they are going to take him someplace, that they have orders. And of course, he then is taken to this very secluded spot where nobody quite knows where it is, where he and 10 other scholars or 10 other people are part of a scientific organization that is going to try to find out what has produced this genetic mutation. I don't want to get too far into the story because I don't want to spoil it for you as you read it, because you know, you go from mystery to mystery to mystery to unanswered question to deception, and then of course always the question is, well, indeed, what is it that what is going on? Because obviously somebody in the group knows what's going on, but of course the scientists are not to be allowed, and they're going to have to learn this step by step. Would that be a fairly fair statement to make?
Yes, it is. It's like unpeeling an onion and finding another onion.
And of course, if you really begin looking into what's going on today, that's exactly what's going on. I mean, how do you really understand, so many of the things that have happened in recent years, whether it be the Kennedy assassination or Roswell or what happened as far as TW 800 or what happened as far as Oklahoma City bombing. There's always something behind the scenes that we can't quite put our finger on. And there obviously has to be some force out there that really is altering things. And you, of course, call this force the group.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's the group again is in the book is the modern version of what in the late 40s and 50s was called MJ-12, which was the group that was created under by President Truman during his administration to deal with whatever UFOs were and whatever happened at Roswell.
Was that Majestic you're talking about?
Yes, yes. Yes, Majestic 12. And I take the tack in the book, and I make no claim to know if they've done this, but I take the tack in the book because the Majestic term has essentially become too familiar that they just do away with the terminology and do away with any internal memoranda that document who is on the group, and they just call themselves the group. But they have inherited the legacy and the task of MJ-12, Majestic 12.
All right, fine. Well, let's go to Don, who's calling in from Spokane, Washington. Hi, Don. How are you doing?
Pretty good. I need a phone number to get a hold of Michael.
Well, we didn't actually have. Basically, we have a couple of websites. Is there an email or any other way to get in touch with you?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I need a phone number. I don't have any of that modern stuff.
Okay. he does. This gentleman doesn't have any. He doesn't have a computer, obviously.
No.
Well, I was going to say before he said that, I was going to say if he emailed me, then I could give him my phone number.
You don't want to put it out on the air, or would you want perhaps him to hang on and...
Well, I could. I'm willing to do that.
Well, how about if I have him hang on? Could we give the number that we have here off the air?
Yes, okay. You can.
All right, fine. Well, then, I'll tell you what, Don. I want you to hang on. I'm going to put you on hold, and then I'm going to... ask Kevin, who's our producer tonight, to give you the number, okay?
Okay.
And now, of course, we only do this for very, very special listeners, but since you're a regular listener, we'll do that for you, okay?
Okay.
Okay, you're going to go on to hold. Now, anything else you want to ask?
No, that's it.
I'll tell you, this is a fascinating book.
Oh, I gotta have it.
But of course, you know, the author, you know, I knew where he was coming from because he's a graduate of Bob Jones University. You don't find very many radical leftists coming out of Bob Jones. Hang on, Don. We'll get that number for you. Okay.
Okay.
Okay, and Kevin, if you wouldn't mind picking that up. And again, our telephone number, 464-8295, or out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. And again, of course, you can get in touch with our author at facadenovel.com or Michael S. Heisner, HEISNER.com. And if you have any difficulty, of course, you can always call our number here at...
Dr. Monty?
Yes, uh-huh.
Yeah, it's actually Heiser, H-E-I-S-E-R.
H-E-I-S-E-R, I'm sorry, H-E-I-S-E-R.com. Thank you so very much. Okay, and of course, now if you get into the book, you know, and there's a question of what is happening, and of course, basically, the scenario you paint is of a major cataclysmic event which is going to impact society and really totally disrupt not only the society of the United States, but the society of the entire world. And it's up to this group of 11 people to come up with a solution. Would that be a fair statement?
Yeah, and they're there for, in many respects, for damage control. You know, there are three or four layers of deception and misdirection in the book, as you know, having read it. And damage control is a large part of this. They finally, quote unquote, get the group to, you know, come clean, which they're never actually sure if they do, and even the reader isn't quite sure if they do. But the part of the damage control is to ready society for a peaceful transition to the idea that they are here, that ETs are here, and that they control our destiny. To get us out of this fix that we're in. It's sort of a cosmic game of chicken that is presented to the team of scholars. But gradually, even that begins to unravel. And the spiritual figures in the book, those who are believers and have a, you know, take the scriptures seriously, are always questioning, is this really the final layer here? Is this really the truth? And eventually, they have to come to terms with the fact that, well, this is much worse. The truth is much worse than what we've been told, and we are essentially in danger of being in league with the devil. But do we have any power to even confront it? And the way the book ends, it's obviously going to need more space. And essentially, the lead character becomes the central figure in this amazingly intricate conspiracy, confronting beings that he's still, at the end of the book, hasn't even seen. But he knows that they're out there, doesn't quite know what to do, but he's going to try to be faithful and expose the lie. And that's where he's left at the end of the book.
You know, there is a placard on the wall of Agent Fox Mulder's office in the basement of the FBI building, if you ever watched the X-Files. And
oh, yeah.
It said, you know, the truth is out there. And of course, he was always looking for this truth. Well, you know, unfortunately, of course, he wasn't coming from a Christian point of view, although in the very last program on the series, he was beginning to look at the cross and realize that there was something there, although I think that they were looking for the wrong sort of spirituality. Mm-hmm. But this has always been, down through the ages, people have recognized this, haven't they?
Yeah, there's a lot. And you bring up the X-Files. There is a lot of, innuendo in that show that suggests that some of the creators and writers, I think, at least want to be willing to see this as a spiritual confrontation, a spiritual reality. But the stumbling block that people come across is if you accept that, then you become accountable. You become accountable to these forces, good or evil, and you have to make choices about the Bible, essentially. And again, for the person who hasn't, one of the things the facade does is for the person who all they know is just a little gray face on the TV, if that's all you know, you can pick up the facade, and it's like UFO studies 101. I mean, it gets you into the subject, the issues that are there, and specifically one of the things that it does for people who would be accepting or at least contemplating a biblical worldview is it shows you the continuity between what passes for this extraterrestrial quote-unquote reality today. It's nothing more than a new manifestation of a very old evil. And there are threads. I've taken the time to read lots of abduction literature, and I try again. I only use academic sources. Let me give you a for instance. In the book, I reference a conference on alien abductions at MIT, which occurred in 1992. That isn't a prop in the book. That's real. Okay. And you can buy the papers in a very large volume. The papers that were delivered at MIT discussing the alien abduction phenomenon. And one of them documents a long list of similarities between abductee testimony and those people who are victims of satanic ritual abuse and dissociative disorder trauma. It's things like that I look at, and I put little threads in the book. There's an abortion clinic scene in the book that is never given closure, and that is because it's going to be a thread in other books to come. That this industry is somehow tied to, again, part of this overall agenda. But there are things like that I'll take that MIT paper, and it's good scholarly stuff, and I will say, okay, well, no kidding. There's a similarity between this, and it's not just one or two things. It's 30 elements, even down to the tables, to the surgical procedures, you know, that people who are victims are given a what psychologists would call a screensaver memory, and it's usually something to do with aliens and this wonderful message. And yes, even though we're abusing you, we're here to help you. And you know, the whole Stockholm syndrome takes over in a lot of abductee victims, that they begin to identify positively with their captors and agree with their agenda and look at them as really having their best intentions in mind. You read this stuff that are coming from mainstream academics, people who claim to have been abducted by aliens, and if you have a background in, you know, essentially things like MK Ultra, you know, mind control technology that is public knowledge now. You know, and if that's public knowledge, then a whole lot of other things aren't. And I try to use credible academic sources, scholars in various fields, pick up these threads and say, well, the truth is out there. Connect the dots.
And I think I think it's so interesting. Was that Dr. Mark, is it?
Mac.
Yeah. At Harvard.
John Mac at Harvard.
And he had, what, 5,000 people he interviewed, alien abduction, some fantastic number.
Yeah, he has quite a large number. So does Jacobs at Temple.
And
those are the two major mainstream academics that do this sort of thing.
And here, you know, he's interviewed these people who all say they've been abducted. Mm-hmm. You know, and I can remember the first time I heard a story of somebody being abducted out here in Aptos, where I live. And this was, what, 25 years ago, 30 years ago. And these guys got to really be the craziest people in the world. After you've heard this story over and over again, you realize that there really is something out there. And then, of course, this phenomenal similarity between the stories. They didn't necessarily talk to one another. They didn't read one another's books. Something happened to all of these people.
You know, and people say, well, they come forward with these stories because they want their 15 minutes of fame. Well, anybody who says that hasn't read the literature. These people, yeah, they do become famous, but they also lose their spouses and lose their jobs and, you know, lose their pensions and their income. It essentially wrecks their lives. You know, people aren't willing to be considered the village idiot. You know, but eventually they just become so traumatized that they either just totally put it away or they just have to speak for their own sanity. And, you know, guys like Mac and Jacobs, who now have an open door, and they're very high-profile academics. And that's one of the things I want listeners to realize, that this used to be laughable. It is no longer laughable when people at Harvard and Temple and MIT are trying to study it. And studying it is one thing, but in the process of doing so, they are erecting a worldview, a paradigm in front of our eyes that I believe, and the tack I take in the book, is that this ultimate reality paradigm involving intelligent, benevolent extraterrestrials who are here for our own benefit, I think that will become a contending paradigm in the future, a contending worldview in the future. I think it'll be the next. It won't undo Darwinism. It can work with Darwinism, but it'll be the next big thing to come along. On my website, I have a PDF copy version of the New York Times dated April 8th, 2001. I reference this in the book too, where for the first time that I had seen in print, the New York Times links the Christian intelligent design movement, you know, that is combating Darwinism, people like Philip Johnson and Michael Behe, mainstream scholars who are defending creationism, maybe not young earth creationism, but creationism nonetheless. The New York Times linked intelligent design with the possibility that we might not have a designer, but designers, with an S on the end. And they actually say in the New York Times that this could be intelligent extraterrestrials.
And of course, they don't ever ask where the intelligent extraterrestrials
right.
came from,
right.
who
it
created
solves,
life. Right.
It solves nothing, but it is a convenient substitute for Darwinism. I think that's an example of everybody is in love, you know, with the intelligent design movement, and I'm a fan too, because it helps defend creationism. But what they don't realize is that all the people need to do is say, okay, you win that argument, we're going to put an S on the end, and now you've got designers.
Well, you know, of course, the problem is that man will do anything so he doesn't have to face the reality that there's
Correct.
A God, because if there's a God,
Correct.
Then he's answerable to that God,
right.
and he can't do exactly what he wants to.
Right.
And the problem of modern time is we want to be free. We don't want to have somebody saying, thou shalt not do this, and thou shalt not do that. And you don't
have to have that, because not only will you have designers, but you won't have any of these commands to worry about. I didn't even get into this in the book, but the sequel is going to have a lot to do with it. The idea that, again, if you spend any time in ufological literature, that our great spiritual leaders, Jesus included, were either hybrid beings, you know, created by the ETs, or had ET influence to make these great leaps of enlightened consciousness. I mean, it's just, you know.
I mean, that's their thought, not yours
yeah,
necessarily, right?
Right. It's as bogus as the day is long, but it is part of what I see as an alternate paradigm being constructed, literally under the nose of the church.
Well, you know, it's so interesting. You know, there have been these very shifts. First of all, we had, of course, majority of people believing Christianity, and then you had this atheistic movement, and this really humanism and atheism go together, of course. And then, of course, from there, you go over into this sort of spiritual, new agey type of thing,
and
the new spirituality,
at.
Right?
Yep.
And so you shift from one position to another, and then there's a second paradigm shift. And that is the scary one, because there's so many people today who are looking for spirituality every place outside of the church.
And it's spirituality that, again, makes no claim on your life other than to believe it. But the centers of it, the focus of it, in my view, are the ones that have always tried to be the focus. You know, the fallen sons of God, the watchers, they become our spiritual substitutes, which is why, you know, they have always appeared in some manner to be technologically superior. You know, in the ancient world, we throw around this term called Gnosticism all the time, coming from gnosis, which means knowledge. Salvation in the ancient world had a lot to do with acquiring secret, esoteric, special knowledge. Why? Because that's what made you like a god.
Right.
Okay, in other words, they weren't thinking atonement and need to, you know, cover for sin, you know, outside the biblical worldview. What they're saying is that we need to become like the gods, and how do we do this? We need to know what they know. That's why people were into producing altered states. That's why they were, you know, into, you know, tapping into quote-unquote lost technologies. You know, these alternative paradigms that converge not only in the New Age movement, but they converge especially in a movement that has as its technological and spiritual masters the gods.
Right.
And these beings will claim to be our gods.
And we would like to be like them. We've got Susan calling here from Santa Cruz. Hi, Susan. How are you doing?
Hi there. I think you said you studied angels, Michael?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a special interest.
Okay. Well, demons are basically angels that have gone to the other side, right? So they have similar abilities that they use, right?
Yeah. I actually believe that there's a hierarchy that includes beings that we call angels, but there are other beings who are above angels but below God himself. But it's kind of six of one and a half dozen of the other for the sake of the conversation.
Well, but then where do the demons fit in?
Well, if you go just from a strictly textual standpoint, in the Bible, we're not told where demons originate, where they come from. They're more or less there. We're not told when the angels, when the B'nai HaElohim, the sons of God, which I like to call the divine beings. We're not told where they come from. We're told that God made them and that they fell. We're not told when. If you go beyond that into the intertestamental period, then the explanation for them is kind of interesting. If you go back to the Genesis 6 incident, when the sons of God came down and cohabited with human women and bore what the Bible calls Nephilim, when you killed one of these in intertestamental literature, since they were essentially a divine-human hybrid, the flesh would die, but what was left behind became known as the Shadim, which are the demons, or the shadows, the shadow beings. And that is the Jewish worldview's explanation in between the testaments for where these entities come from.
Now, what books would you be referring to?
Enoch specifically.
All right.
Book of Enoch and some of the Book of Jubilees, too. But they do share these properties with their quote-unquote forefathers, you know, certain abilities and certain, you know, levels of high intelligence. Curiously, one of them, again, for those who are familiar with the X-Files, you'll recognize this immediately. Enoch very explicitly states that a watcher or a fallen watcher can take any form that they wish. Okay, they can metamorphosize right in front of your eyes.
Well, I saw them do that all the time on the X-Files.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And I don't know if they were looking that up, but that is right out of the Book of Enoch for these fallen beings. They also appear, they're also described as being reptilian in appearance as well, in a couple Dead Sea Scrolls too, specifically 4Q Amram. There are two fragments of that scroll. And again, these scrolls are things I reference in the book, too.
Okay, well, look, we're just about out of time. I hope I can get you on again, either on this program or some of our other programs,
sure.
Because, of course, you're a fountain of knowledge, and it's so refreshing to have somebody that really does have the scholarly background to try to interpret all of these things for us. Susan, we're out of time, but thanks so much for calling. Bye-bye. And again, our guest has been Michael Heisner, his book, Facade. And, of course, you can go to the website at facadenovel.com or Michael Heiser, S. Heiser, HEISER.com. Got it right that time?
Yep, you got it.
Okay. Thank you so very much for being with us. It's been a real pleasure, and we'll look forward to having you back again one of these days.
Well, anytime.
Thanks so very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, fine. Well, I hope you enjoyed the program. This is a little different program, but these are things we have to talk about because we're involved in a spiritual battle. And if you don't realize that the demons are real, the angels are real, too. Of course, they're manifestations of the spirit world. And we only, of course, are living in the reality. And yet, perhaps the reality is the spirit world, and our life is an illusion under any circumstances. Please pray for America, and we'll be back with you again on Monday. Until then, may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. Now, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for a while. Hold them for at least 15 minutes or so because I want to spend some time talking to Bruce Adamson, who's with us this hour. And Bruce has spent almost a decade now becoming the world's leading expert on a man named George de Morenschild. Now, why is George de Morenschild important? Well, because he was Lee Harvey Oswald's mentor. He was Lee Harvey Oswald's handler. And, of course, George de Morenschild is a shadowy figure. He was actually, Bruce was able to get hold of his telephone book, his personal telephone book. And there you found the numbers of people like George Bush and Lyndon Johnson, and he had all sorts of connections with key people and in the Central Intelligence Agency and, of course, relationships with all sorts of important people, with the father of the young man who died in the car wreck with Princess Diana. And we'll get into a lot of these things a little bit later. But the story of Lee Harvey Oswald, the truth has never been told. Last evening we had a fascinating program with Craig Roberts, Colonel Craig Roberts, and of course we went into this concept that many people believe that there was not one but two Lee Harvey Oswalds. And after the program, we spent, at least an hour with Craig, as he told me about a gentleman who had spent the last 20 years of his life trying to search and reach the real Lee Harvey Oswald, and how time and time again he would be there, ready, and he would, of course, Lee Harvey Oswald, the real Lee Harvey Oswald, not the one who was killed at the police station in Dallas, but the real Lee Harvey Oswald, who was obviously been recruited by the CIA and then replaced with another man who looked very much like him, but who was fluent in Russian. And, of course, Lee Harvey Oswald, a young man who never finished school, was always the school cut-up, never really very efficient, certainly not a good student at all, suddenly is speaking fluent Russian. He is given a key position at a key military base where the U-2 flights are being scheduled that are being flown over Russia. And how did he get to this position? Where did he learn to be fluent in Russian? And why, when he went home for his mother's his mother was ill, did he suddenly take off and go to Russia and was never considered AWOL and then was brought back to the United States by our government along with his wife, who was the niece of a colonel in the Soviet secret police. There's so many unanswered questions out there, and perhaps Bruce can help us answer some of them. Bruce, how are you tonight?
I'm great.
All right, fine. Have you ever heard that theory that there may have been two people?
I'm not an expert on that. All I focus in on is George de Morenschild.
And you do a great job on it. So why don't you tell our listeners what got you into looking up at this man who most people have never heard of, or he seems to be sort of an ancillary or a side issue in the whole story. And yet, of course, an understanding of George de Morenschild's gives increased understanding of the forces behind the murder of an American president and the fact that this has been covered up going on 39 years now.
Well, I've been a genealogist since 1982, and I started on my family, Rufus Easton and George Ely. Rufus was first postmaster of St. Louis, appointed by Thomas Jefferson. George Ely was secretary of the New York Stock Exchange for 45 years. And as a genealogist, I have a different technique of researching, and I'm able to research people that are famous instead of ones that have criminal records, like Oswald or somebody you know, people that are famous don't really have records. And I kind of tie connections together, take associations, and bring them together. And I spent 8 months going around the U.S. in my motorhome, hitting all the libraries, and taking the material that I discovered and putting it together and making, not forcing the pieces to fit, but just making a story out of it. And George de Mornschild, he just connected to so many people. I have a letter from George Bush on my website admitting that he had been friends with de Mornschild since 1942. And I found out that Abe Zapruder worked with de Mornschild back in, or Mrs. George de Mornschild back in 1953.
Now that's the Zapruder of the Zapruder film, right?
Right, right. And I thought to myself, well, it wasn't natural when you hear gunshots that you don't react for your own safety. And Mrs. George de Mornschild and Zapruder worked at a clothing store called Narnes of Dallas.
And, of course, what you're really referring to is here's George de Mornschild standing with his 8mm camera, bullet flying, everybody diving, and he's...
Zapruder,
just,
yeah.
Zapruder, and,
yeah.
And, of course, he's just going ahead shooting the films.
Yeah, and it's and he's steady as a rock, and he even says that he heard the bullets whistle by his ears. Well, geez, if I don't know the shots are coming at me, I'm going to drop to the ground, you know, and... Then I found out that Zapruder and de Mornschild belonged to the same CIA organization, which was co-founded by Neil Mellon, who was George Bush's mentor. And that was the Dallas Council on World Affairs. And they had meetings in de Mornschild's office building, which was a CIA trust building, the Republic National Bank building of Dallas. And, you know, just one thing led to another. Then I found out that Zapruder and de Mornschild, Mrs. George de Mornschild, back in 1953, we're friends with Olga Femer. Olga Femer is the mother of Marie Femer, who is the first woman senior supervisor at the CIA. And Marie Femer was LBJ's personal secretary at the time, prior to the time of JFK's assassination. And she was there when Lyndon Johnson meets de Mornschild 7 months before the assassination. And she's the one that's taking notes. And she leaves out that de Mornschild and Lyndon Johnson met, even though the CIA produced memos on that.
So there's this obvious, always an effort to cover up the truth.
Right.
And, of course, you really have spent an awful lot of money and time and effort of really pulling this all together. And you've written how many books now?
I've got 13 on, 11 on the JFK assassination, the JFK timeline, and then I took an article. Larry Flint hired me to write an article. He offers $1 million reward, and he hires me to write an article, pays me $500, and then he kills the story. So instead of letting the story die, I published that article. So that's another volume. You know, I figured anybody who boasts about offering $1 million reward, when somebody comes up with the goods, he should produce or, you know, at least publish the article and let other people, you know, be the judge of it.
Well, did he give you the $500? That's what I want to know.
Yeah, yeah. He gave me actually 200 more than the 300 he promised.
Okay. Well, anyway, of course, now, of course, what was the relationship between de Mornschild and Lee Harvey Oswald, George de Mornschild?
Well, it was not really a friendship. It's just somebody who's using somebody to, and kind of sets them up, you know. The title of the books are called Oswald's Closest Friend, the George de Mornschild story. But obviously, if somebody's setting you up for the assassination of a president, he's not your friend. And he's hanging out with Oswald on April the 11th, and then 4 days earlier, de Mornschild's friend, Mrs. Igor Cassini, committed suicide because of Bobby Kennedy. And that's a whole, there's a whole volume dedicated just to that. And Mrs. Igor Cassini was Charlene Reitzman of Palm Beach. And every time Lyndon Johnson went to Palm Beach, he stayed at Charlene Reitzman's father's house, and that was Charles Reitzman. And Charlene Reitzman's grandfather was the author of the oil depletion allowance. So.
All right, fine. Well, of course, as far as de Mornschild was concerned, did you find definite evidence that he was at close ties to the Central Intelligence Agency?
Well, yeah, my latest volume is on de Mornschild's father-in-law. And his father-in-law was in charge of more than 250 CIA agents from 1950 to 53, 10 years before the assassination. why didn't the Warren Commission or the House Select Committee tell us that Lee Harvey Oswald's best friend's father-in-law is in charge of 250 CIA agents? Why did they keep this from us?
Well, wasn't there much more about the Warren Cell's relationship with the Central Intelligence Agency? I really think that this would be something that people would be very interested in, because, of course, the Central Intelligence Agency, most people think that it's supposed to have something to do with gathering intelligence throughout the world. No, it's influencing our domestic policies. It's worked closely with the CIA, with the mafia for years, and you don't believe that. You need to read the book Double Cross, written by Chuck Giancano, Sam Giancano's brother. And, of course, the mafia and the CIA, almost like one great big organization with two different heads. But anyway, what were the tie-ins between de Morenschild and the American Intelligence Agency?
You mean the CIA?
Yes, right. The
CIA or the OSS?
No, well, of course. Well, the whole tying him into the intelligence agencies, OSS, CIA, the whole ball of
wax. Worked for William F. Buckley's father,
was Buckley's father a Skull and Bones too?
I don't think so. No, he was the owner of Panampiqui Oil in Venezuela, and DeMorenschel worked for him in the mid '40s. And de Morenschel worked for was offered a job at Nelson Rockefeller's Inter-American Affairs in the 1940s. And the government, after the assassination, made de Morenschel out to be a Nazi, which is simply not true. De Morenschel has roots going back into the Swiss Baltic, but his mother was Sapolsky from Poland. And de Morenschel married Samuel Walter Washington's daughter, and that's Samuel Walter Washington was the man who was in charge of 250 CIA agents from 1950 to 1953. Now, Samuel Walter Washington married somebody who was Jewish, so which means that his daughter was Jewish who married de Morenschel. And so they married in 1948, and I said to myself way back in 1994, how can de Morenschel be a Nazi, according to the House Select Committee, if he's marrying into somebody, a Jewish family? And de Morenschel was friends with Sam Paley, who was the owner of CBS and the founder of CBS, and is also Jewish. And de Morenschel had a lot of Jewish friends. And I said to myself, wait a minute, something's not right here. And so at that time, in 1994, I served him with the Freedom of Information Act, and at the last election, I was in Lofton, Nevada, when they sent me 300 pages on de Morenschel's father-in-law's personnel file from the State Department, and that was before the November election. And so I worked on it and produced another volume on that, and that's just part of the story.
Okay, well, why don't you give it as much as you can, because, of course, our people out there really want to know, I think, about George de Morenschel, his tie-in to our intelligence agencies, and if he was tied into the intelligence agencies, what was Lee Harvey Oswald's tie to American intelligence agencies? And, of course, if he was tied into the intelligence agencies, what part then did they play in the assassination of the American president?
Well, they obviously, I mean, it's my opinion, they played a big role, and I found out that Alan Dulles, who was a CIA director and Warren commissioner after the assassination, his uncle and de Morenschel's grandfather by marriage, William Gibbs McAdoo, and Robert Lansing was Alan Dulles' uncle, co-founded the Secret Service together in World War One.
Now, you're talking about de Morenschel's
grandfather by marriage.
Grandfather by marriage.
Yeah.
And, of course, then the relatives of Alan Dulles created the Secret Service in the First World War.
1915.
And then, of course, Alan Dulles was an official, a very high official in the OSS during the Second World War.
Right.
And at the end of the Second World War, then he was the first director of the Central Intelligence Agency, which became what many people feel is America's invisible government. So pick up the story then, of course. Now, what was the relationship between, is there a direct relationship between Dulles and de Morenschel?
Yeah, I have a letter from Alan Dulles 3 days after he took over office as CIA director in 1953, 10 years before the assassination, to de Morenschel's brother. And I didn't find it at the CIA. I didn't win it in a Freedom of Information Act. I found it at the Hoover Institute in Dmitry von Mornschild's Russian Review papers. So, and that letter proves that they knew that their relatives co-founded the Secret Service together.
Okay. And was this just a friendly letter, or how did it happen that Donald Dulles was writing to the Mornschild's
Have you ever heard of George or Peter Weyrich?
Yeah, sure. George Weyrich was a Nazi, pro-German agent during the First World War.
He wrote a book, right. And his son was kind of an anti-Bolshevik writer afterwards, Peter Weyrich, and a professor. He's still alive. And Peter wrote a story called Trojan Dove, which was published in Dmitry von Mornschild's article, newspaper, Russian Review. And so... the article is about how the government uses these radio programs to infiltrate the eastern board countries, the Slavic countries, and, you know, crush communism, kind of like as a metaphor for the wooden horse and the Trojan horse.
Right.
And
Weyrich, of course, was, I know he was pro-German during the First World War. Where was he during the Second World War?
Well, he was kind of quiet.
All right.
He was still in America, and made a little noise, but not as much. And his son was the other way around. His son wasn't so boisterous.
Okay, fine. Well, now, were there any other ties between de Mornschild and the CIA? Certainly, de Mornschild knew George Bush quite well, didn't he?
Yes, they knew. I have a letter from Bush in 1993, dated that he knew de Mornschild since 1942. Bush's roommate at Andover when he went to prep school was Edward Gordon Hooker, who happens to be the nephew of George de Mornschild.
Wait a minute now. George Bush's roommate was de Mornschild's nephew?
Right. Edward Gordon Hooker. And Edward Gordon Hooker is a cousin to, I think it's Mrs. John D. Rockefeller III, who was, her first name escapes me, but her maiden name was Hooker.
Okay. So basically, but these are all sort of vague relationships. Did de Mornschild ever meet with Bush, or did he ever have any other...
Oh, yeah, I have letters from Bush as the chairman of the Republican Party under Nixon, representing de Mornschild for his project in Haiti.
Wait a minute now, Bush is writing representing de Mornschild?
Right. And it's his stationery, and it's his letter from the... as the chairman of the Republican Party.
And what is he actually saying?
Well, he's trying to get de Mornschild to get paid for his services for Papa Doc Duvalier.
Okay, so de Mornschild then has been working for Papa Doc, who was the dictator of
Haiti.
And, of course, George Bush certainly wouldn't be writing as a lawyer. Was he writing and
As a friend.
Now, what year was that? Was this when he was the director of the CIA?
No, 1973, I believe. It could have been 71 or 73.
Well, he should have been with the CIA at that time, wasn't he? Was he with the CIA at
that
time?
Oh, he was in the CIA. He was in charge of the Bay of Pigs invasion, one of the men in charge.
So that was, of course,
Operation Zapata.
1961.
Yeah, right. April, was it 15th or 13th or something like that? 1961, and that was codenamed by the CIA Operation Zapata, as in George Bush's oil company, Zapata Oil. And what proves that he was in charge of that is that he was partners in an oil company in Mexico City with Edwin Pauley, who was the chairman of the Democratic Party in California. Edwin Pauley and Bush were partners, and they're both listed in de Mornschild's phone book. Now, Edwin Pauley and relative I spoke to, and I said, I called her and I asked if there was anything unusual about anything that happened unusual prior to the Bay of Pigs invasion. She said that her father-in-law called her and said that if anything should go wrong, that they had their house in Bel Air bomb shelter stocked with supplies, so that they should go there. And this is...
They were then fearing there might be a nuclear confrontation as a result of the Bay of Pigs?
Yeah, that's the implication that she made.
All right, fine. Well, of course, I think that it's important to understand that George Bush, this is George Herbert Walker Bush, come out of the skull and bones, which is was recognized even back in 1870, simply less than 40 years after its origin, as a satanic organization. In fact, we've just put together a syllabus which lists the name of every member of the skull and bones. And
Neil Mellon was a member, and Neil Mellon founded the Dallas Council on World Affairs.
Right. And, of course, we have that available, the membership list of all of the people of the Skull and Bones going back to 1833. And, of course, we explained to you what we think the number 322 beneath the crossed thigh bones in their emblem is. I think it's unique because nobody else has a list of all the members of the Skull and Bones, and we have it, and we got it from the Skull and Bones. Well, anyway, I won't tell you how we got it, but that's a long story. Anyway, of course, the information is available, and you find the people who lead the conservatives and the people who lead the liberals all come from this. And George Herbert Walker Bush came from there, as did his father, Prescott Bush. And there have been six Bushes who have been members of the Skull and Bones Society, a secret satanic society at Yale University.
Now, which six Bushes were there?
Well, we'd have to get the copy of the list now.
I didn't know that there were that many. I just knew Prescott and George H.W., but I'm not an expert on that.
Don't feel bad. I wasn't either. I was amazed to find there were nine Tafts and six Bushes.
The Tafts, I do know, yeah.
Right, and the people who rule America all come from this secret society.
Now, did you know Mrs. Horace Taft, who was the daughter of Mary Bancroft? Now, Mary Bancroft is she was the lover of Allen Dulles. And Mary Bancroft was simultaneously the lover of Henry Luce. Now, Mary Bancroft worked with Allen Dulles on the assassination attempt on Adolf Hitler in the OSS. And there's a book called Autobiography of a Spy. Now, in that book, Mary Bancroft mentions her best friend as Ruth Forbes Payne, who happens to be the mother of Michael and Ruth Payne of Irving, Texas, who are putting the Oswalds up in their home. But Mary Bancroft's father was Hugh Bancroft, who owned Dow Jones, Barron's, and the Wall Street Journal. And her daughter, Mrs. Horace Taft, married the president of Yale University, is the owner, the largest stockholder of the Santa Cruz Sentinel today.
And now, of course, what was the Paynes doing putting up Lee Harvey Oswald, this man who had come back from Russia, who had married the...
And they have close ties to the CIA director, Allen Dulles.
Right. I mean, so why were they putting up this man, Lee Harvey Oswald?
And the Payne's mother, Ruth Forbes Payne, now Michael and it's Ruth Hyde Payne that are putting up the Oswalds. They both have the same name, Ruth. Ruth Forbes Payne, she married Arthur Young, the inventor of the Bell helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
And Arthur Young and Ruth Forbes Payne, his closest friend was, for 50 years, was Payson Loomis, who happened to be the spiritual advisor to Dmitri von Mornschild, if you can believe that. And Payson Loomis was the personal secretary to Gurdjieff. Have you ever heard of Gurdjieff?
Never have.
Okay, he was like a triple spy for Russian and went to school with Stalin, and he was a philosopher.
Now, how do you get to be a triple spy? I mean, I've heard of being a spy, and I've heard of a double spy, but a triple spy...
Oh, he was all over the place.
That's sort of like these philosophers who talk about the 10th dimension. I understand the first dimension, the second dimension, the third dimension, and I'm a little shaky on the fourth. They get to the 10th, they've lost me.
Yeah, I hear you.
Okay, but anyway, he was a three-way spy, a triple spy.
Yeah,
Who is he spying for, then?
Well, they said he... Well, I'm not an expert on Gurdjieff.
Okay, fine. All right, fine.
I stick to de Mornschild. I make a few connections, but there you have it. The Paynes are connected to de Mornschild, his brother.
Now, who was it who got Lee Harvey Oswald the job in the Texas
Ruth, Ruth Hyde Payne.
All right, fine. So here are these people, and they obviously are fairly well-to-do, aren't they?
No, they weren't.
They
weren't.
Huh?
But the parents were.
All right, fine.
And the parents... were trying to help Marina Oswald about 7 months before the assassination.
All right, then. Was Lee living with Marina at this time?
Lee was, at the time of the assassination, Lee was visiting on weekends with Marina at the Paints.
I see. Well, then why were they separated? Or was it
Oh, they were fighting, you know, just, you know, cats and dogs, fighting like a husband and wife would fight.
Well, I don't know. I don't know how husbands and wives fight.
I know you don't fight.
Because I got a nice wife.
Yeah.
Anyway, our telephone number, if you'd like to give us a call, 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. If you have a question for our guest is Bruce Adamson, and he is the world's leading expert on George de Mornfeld. And this is simply another one of the important tracks that should convince anybody with two brain cells that the story we've gotten about the Kennedy assassination was as phony as a $3 bill. In other words, the one thing we could not allow the American people ever to learn is that there were organized effort to kill Kennedy, and it went to the highest levels of the people who really ruled our country. And, of course, it was covered up by the Central Intelligence Agency, by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. A lot of people get mad at me when I say that J. Edgar Hoover and the impression we have of him is more illusion than reality, but there's no way they could have gotten away with the assassination other than, of course, to have got J. Edgar Hoover to go along with him. And, of course, it had to involve the people who controlled the media, many of the book publishing houses, and there are many books on the Kennedy assassination, for instance, that have been written and paid for by publishers, and they're never printed, so they never saw the light of day. This is how you suppress information in America. But then who do you tell that, you know, they brought my book, they paid for my book, and then they never let me get the book in print? Well, there are all sorts of techniques of controlling access to information. And, of course, this is the problem we face today, as Thomas Jefferson had said so well. Any nation that expects to remain both free and ignorant in a state of civilization expects what never was and never will be. Our guest is Bruce Adamson. If you have a question or comment, our telephone number, 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Bruce, how can people get a list of your books and the information? You have a website, don't you?
Yeah, and I have the books. Would rather them they go to you, and so I can give you some kind of a credit, you know. Or
Well, why don't we just have them go to you, and if they come through us, why, you can get in touch with us, okay?
Sure. It's, the website is just CIAJFK.com.
CIAJFK.com. Okay.
And they can find my name on, in a link to most of the JFK books right on your website, and I'm like the third name down on the first page.
Okay, fine. Well, okay. So if you find his name there and you want to come to us, that's fine as well.
And that's why, you know, I can make a donation to Radio Liberty.
All right, fine. Well, we'll appreciate that. And these are fascinating books. It's the, you know, there's information here you're never going to get elsewhere. And there's all these various intricate ties, you know, the behind the scenes of relationship of one group to another. In fact, you even have a timeline of de Mornfeld, don't you?
Yeah, that's probably the, it's from the first 10 volumes, and that's probably one of the best books, you know, because it shows you everything happening in chronological order, and it shows you who's communicating to who, and has a biographical dictionary of the individuals, you know, that are a part of de Mornfeld's life and that are just key figures. So I really like it, but it's kind of a boring read if you don't like reading things in order. You know, it's just put in order, but it's facts from the first 10 volumes.
Well, of course, I think that sometimes that's the easiest way to correlate these things in your mind.
That's right.
And I love a timeline. I think it's really very, very beneficial. So if you'd like to get more information, you can go to RadioLiberty.com, or, of course, you can go to CIAJFK.com and get information on these books. And, of course, these books are for people who really want to get an entirely different slant on this, no question at all, that de Mornfeld was tied to the CIA, and, of course, Lee Harvey Oswald was tied to the CIA. And the question has to be asked, well, if that's really true, why hasn't Barbara Walters and Dan Rather and Tom Brokaw told us that? And the answer should be quite obvious. Why, you will never you are never to know the truth about what really happened or who killed President Kennedy. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when we have to remind you that our program is listener-supported. And if you listen to us on a regular basis, we hope that many of you will decide that you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters and help us as we reach out across America with the news behind the news, the story behind the story, trying to get people to understand what's going on. We're involved in a spiritual battle, being fought on a political and ideological and cultural battlefield. But behind that battle are these dark spiritual forces we talked about in the first hour that, of course, energize everything that's going on today. And there is massive blindness in our society to reality and as to spiritual things. And until people understand that, they can't understand anything going on today. And whether it be the UFOs or whether it be the assassination of an American president and how that could be covered up. And once you can begin to see things clearly, you can, from a spiritual point of view, that all of the other factors, everything else begins to fall into place. So we hope that many of you will feel that you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family. And when you do, you get the four best tapes in a month. You get the monthly newsletter. And, of course, we encourage you to copy those tapes and copy the newsletters and help us to get the truth out across America. But, of course, we also hope that if you'd like to get a copy of our newsletter, a free copy of the newsletter, we'll be glad to send it to you. Our telephone number, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. That's 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Let me suggest either the June or the July newsletter. We'll send you either one free if you haven't had one before. And, of course, the June one deals with the polio vaccine that was used between 1955 and 1963. And in 1961, why the government and the manufacturers realized that, of course, it contained a cancer-producing virus. So Merck and Parke Davis both pulled their polio vaccine out to market, but the other two companies left the polio vaccine on the market, and millions of Americans received polio vaccine that everyone, at least within the small cabal in Washington, D.C., knew contained a cancer-producing virus, SV40. In fact, just a week ago today in the Wall Street Journal, there was an article about that. And if you didn't see it, would like to read it, we'd be glad to get it for you. And now, of course, people are dying of the cancers that I believe are produced by SV40, and many people who've studied this believe are produced by SV40, because SV40 is specifically a cancer virus. You put it in almost any animal, and it will produce cancer. And in fact, the whole genome project that they have to decipher the human genome really started with SV40. And they deciphered the genetic makeup of SV40. The virus is cancer-producing virus, the 40th simian virus found in the polio vaccine. And they did this because they wanted to find out what in that virus produced cancer. What was the gene that made the cells in human bodies, or pardon me, in animal bodies, begin proliferating and producing cancer? And, of course, they eventually found that. But, of course, they can't let the American people know the truth. Now, if you'd like to get a copy of my June newsletter, give us a call. 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, the July newsletter, goes into the next stage because, of course, they found that the cancer virus was only in rhesus monkeys. So they decided, well, we'll get away from that because we're so smart. We're going to begin growing the polio virus in green monkeys. So they shifted to green monkeys, and they never bothered to check and see what viruses the green monkeys carried. Well, that's, of course, the story you're going to learn if you get my July newsletter. If you'd like a free copy of one of the newsletters, give us a call at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. That's 1-800-544-8927. And, of course, you'll hear a story, you'll read a story that you're never going to read elsewhere. And, of course, the various stories you're going to read there on Tuskegee and the Qatar vaccine debacle. And then, of course, the cover-up, because we can't let the American people know. Why, if the American people knew, they'd lose confidence in our leaders in Washington, D.C. So they've lied for 40 years. And remember the number to call? 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because we are at war today. Well, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, I guess this evening, Bruce Adamson, and of course his books deal with George de Morenschild. If you're out there in the listening audience and would like to give us a call, our number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 here in the Central Coast of California. If you have a question or comment for Bruce, and certainly there's nobody who I know who has the information on de Morenschild that that Bruce does. Now, actually, a lot of this information came from his personal telephone book that he had with him when he died, didn't it, Bruce?
De Morenschild's, yeah.
Right. Well, why don't you tell us how you got that, and about de Morenschild's death shortly after he received a subpoena to appear before a congressional committee, the House Select Committee, that was investigating the assassination of President Kennedy.
Well,
pardon me, is there something on in the background? Are you a regular telephone?
I'm on a cell phone. I can go on the other phone.
Would you mind?
I mean, not a cell phone, a cordless.
Okay, would you mind getting a regular phone?
No.
Fine, thank you. Okay, fine. So we'll get a little
bit. Yeah, here.
Okay, that's much better. Thank you.
Well, de Morenschild committed suicide on March 29th, 1977, and in the previous year, 76, and I believe it was August, de Morenschild was writing to CIA Director George Herbert Walker Bush, and vice versa. Bush was writing to de Morenschild. And they're mentioned, these letters are mentioned in a CIA memo, but they're no longer part of the CIA records. They've been destroyed, purged. And I sued the CIA in the San Jose District Court to learn this.
Now, why would they destroy the letters unless they were trying to conceal something? I mean, they keep all sorts of records. Why would they destroy those records?
Well,
correspondence between George Herbert Walker Bush and de Morenschild, unless they contained evidence that they didn't want the American people to know about.
That's right. And after they were written, de Morenschild, about 2 months later, received 9 shock treatments at Parkland Hospital, which, in my opinion, causes him to commit suicide. And even though he commits suicide, if those shock treatments are intentionally given to him, it's not suicide, it's murder.
All right, fine. Of course, this is a man who had to be silenced, as had so many other people. In fact, we carry one book called The Dead Witnesses, 109 people who had knew something about the assassination or witnessed one or another aspect, and they all died under mysterious circumstances, and I'm sure de Morenschild is not listed among them. So anyway, of course, he commits suicide, and isn't this shortly after he is subpoenaed to appear before the House Select Committee?
Yeah, on the same day.
What a coincidence.
Same day, and on the same day he meets with Edward J. Epstein. And Edward J. Epstein's a good friend of Sidney Blumenthal, who was Bill Clinton's advisor at the White House.
All right, fine. And so shortly after the meeting, de Morenschild commits suicide, right?
That's right.
All right. Now, how did you get hold of his telephone book, his telephone directory?
Well, in 1990, when I won my case against the post office, they gave me 2 years back pay, which was $38,000. And I said, well, you know, I'm going to do something. My dad always told me as a kid, you know, to invest in yourself. So, you know, I was going to either write a story about how as a kid I had a hard time and I turned myself around and did good things and, you know, and try to encourage somebody. And then they came out with a movie right at the same time. I won my $38,000 on Christmas Eve in 1991. And I took that and I said, that's when Oliver Stone's movie came out. And I really didn't like the movie, but I think it had a positive effect. And I said, well, I'm going to make a conclusion on the JFK assassination. And when I began, I assumed Oswald was guilty as hell, and then I came across George de Morenschild. I went through the 26 volumes, and I read de Morenschild's 240 pages, Mr. and Mrs. de Morenschild's testimony, and I said, wait a minute. Lee Harvey Oswald's best friend dated Jackie Kennedy's mother in 1938. You know, whoa, hold on. You know, I had to grab, I was having a couple nightmares after that one. And then one thing led to another. De Mornschel was tied to Lyndon Johnson, George Bush, all the Texas oil men, CIA agents, FBI agents. I mean, J. Edgar Hoover, the Clint Murchison, who was putting Hoover up in the Del Charro Hotel in San Diego. So it's like, you know, there were things like snowballed, and I just couldn't, you know, keep up with it. But I said, well, nobody, in looking at all these books, no one has ever focused in on George de Mornschel. So, and I knew he committed suicide in Palm Beach, and I knew they had his personal papers. So I wrote a letter to, and I served him with the Freedom of Information Act, even though it didn't carry weight as a federal agency. They're not. They're only a state agency. And I said, you don't, you know, if you don't have the time to go through de Mornschel's phone book and research everybody in there, but if you give me a copy of this, I will do it, and I'll let you know what I find out. And that was back in 92, and they gave it to me, and I started, took me 2 years and $20,000 to go through, and I researched everybody as a genealogist. I don't force people to be connected. They're either connected or they're not. You know, you can't make somebody be guilty. It's circumstantial evidence, and you have to, it either fits or it doesn't.
Now, here you've got the telephone book. This is personal, a list of telephone numbers you would call. And was George Bush in that?
Oh, yeah, and his nickname, Poppy.
And what about...
The Pot of Oil.
Right, too. And what about Lyndon Johnson?
Lyndon Johnson's name was written in there, and I did a Freedom of Information Act to the Atlantic Pacific Bell Company, I think it was called, to find out if that was his real number, and that was his 1957 senatorial number. So de Mornschel has Lyndon Johnson's, he was the majority whip at the time for the Senate, and he worked across the aisle with Prescott Bush, and de Mornschel had his number.
Okay, and fine. Now, what other names would there be in there? Was Dulles' name there? Any of the
Muhammad Al-Fayed. Should we go there?
All right, let's go to Muhammad Al-Fayed now. For our listeners, this is the father of the young man who was killed in the car with Princess Diana. So what was the relationship between Muhammad Al-Fayed and George de Mornschel?
Well, when de Mornschel is in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, at the time Kennedy is being assassinated, and after, in 1964, Muhammad Al-Fayed, it pretends to be a Kuwaiti, a Muhammad Al-Fayed of, he wasn't Al-Fayed then, he was Muhammad Fayed of Kuwait. Well, he's not Kuwait, he's Egyptian. And he goes into business with Clamar Charles, who happens to be George de Mornschel's business partner. And Clamar Charles goes and meets with Lyndon Johnson with de Mornschel and prior to the assassination, and he wants the CIA to infiltrate the government of Haiti. And to make a long story short, the CIA was monitoring Muhammad Al-Fayed's association with de Mornschel. There's a 30-page memo by James Angleton. And in that memo, I gave you a copy of it. I don't know if you had a chance. I highlighted it. Muhammad Al-Fayed had an affair with de Mornschel's daughter. And then there was a notation under James Angleton's signature by Jane Roman, who happens to be the wife of, I believe it's Howard Roman, who was Alan Dulles' personal secretary. Now, Jane Roman was monitoring Lee Harvey Oswald 3 months before the assassination on that document. But the point is that Muhammad Al-Fayed was representing a gentleman by the name of El Amir Atta, A-T-T-A. Now, El Amir Atta is the same name as the lead hijacker on September 11th, the leader who crashes into the first tower and Trade Tower.
But is there any, can we prove any relationship between Atta? Is that that uncommon a name? And certainly there could be people with the same name. Do we have any firm?
Well, it's not a common name. I went through a lot of books and I tried to nail it down, and it's not a common name. But I can tell you that El Amir Atta, Muhammad Atta, who crashes into the tower, and his father, El Amir Atta, and Muhammad Al-Fayed have relatives of the same name, and that's Syed. Now, that's a common name. But the point that that's circumstantial. But then you look at that Muhammad Al-Fayed was suing the CIA and the Pentagon and lost his lawsuit 2 months before the Trade Center towers.
No, of course, Muhammad Al-Fayed...
He's not too weighty.
He believed that there was a CIA conspiracy, and they were involved in the death of his son. And, of course, he wanted
to... And Diana, Princess Diana.
Right. And, of course, he wanted to get those papers. And there is no way that our government is going to give him the papers. Well, it's all protected in the name of national security.
1,100 pages they had on Princess Diana.
And, of course, she's dead. And so
why were they following her? Why is it so top secret? Why doesn't the American public have a right to know what's in those 1,100 pages?
Well, because we have a secret government, and we cannot let the American people know the truth, because they've really understood that there are people who kill people and kill government leaders and kill American citizens. Why we'd begin to lose confidence in our leaders. And, of course, it has nothing to do with the Democrats. It has nothing to do with the Republicans. It has to do with the people who really rule the world.
Well, and so that was one connection, and then...
But anyway, Al-Fayed, of course, then lost his lawsuit...
On July 13th.
But he has said repeatedly that he believes that there was a conspiracy. Why, is this guy some sort of a nut, or does he know, how these things work? Is there any suggestion that he's been associated with CIA himself?
I have a lawsuit against the CIA. It's been pending since 1998. Sam Farr has been trying to get him to open up... I'm suing the CIA for his entire CIA folder, which dates back to 1964.
This is Muhammad Al-Fayed.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
now they've got an extensive file. Why would they have an extensive file on him?
Well, because that's a good question.
Yeah, but of course, the thing is, they have files on all sorts of American citizens and foreign citizens, and they have recruited all sorts of people here in the United States to spy on other people.
Well,
and they had infiltrated Al Qaeda, and if you don't believe they'd infiltrated Al Qaeda and they knew exactly what was going to happen, give us a call, and we'll send you a copy of an article that appeared on the front page of USA Today, which says they knew exactly what they were going to do. And that article appeared one time and never seen again.
It's illegal for the CIA to harass its citizens.
But they did.
But it's not illegal to use foreign agents or people from foreign countries to harass citizens of the United States.
It's illegal to kill the American president. So, of course,
they
got the people from the Sicilian Mafia, mafia in Marseille to do it. And of course, it was paid for by the CIA. And all the evidence shows that, and a number of can give references to that. Go ahead.
Well, what's important, I think, is the Muhammad Al-Fayed connection to George Bush, and the connection between George Bush to de Moorenschild and the Muhammad Al-Fayed connection to George de Moorenschild.
What was the relationship between Muhammad Al-Fayed and George Herbert Walker Bush?
There you go. The connection is his brother-in-law. Anand Khashoggi, who was the richest man in the world in the 1970s and 80s. Anand Khashoggi lost his nephew in the crash with Princess Diana. And Anand Khashoggi is the personal advisor to the Saudi royal family.
All right, fine.
Now, Muhammad Al-Fayed, when he's in Haiti acting as if he's Kuwait, he's not Kuwait, he's Egyptian. So Muhammad Al-Fayed and Muhammad Atta and his father, El-Amir Atta, are all from Cairo, Egypt, not Kuwait. And Muhammad Al-Fayed is representing El-Amir Atta in 1964. How many years is this? That's like 37 years before the Trade Center crash. Well, Anand Khashoggi was George Bush Sr.'s main man in the Iran-Contra deal. He was the middleman between Lockheed Martin and to get these prisoners released with the missiles. And he's CIA. There's no question about it. And he used to go over with Edwin Pauly to Coconut Island on Edwin Pauly's island outside of Honolulu.
Now, was Pauly a CIA asset as well?
Oh, yeah. He had a direct line to the White House in his Coconut Island. And Lyndon Johnson visited him once there prior to the assassination. And Edwin Pauly, of course, is a Pauly Pavilion at UCLA. But he was a Democrat. He was a big oil man. You know, people, you know, people stereotype Republicans and Democrats, like, oh, they don't work together, you know, but when you're, when there's a plot going, you know, when there's a motive, there's no discrimination on parties.
Now, there's Paley and there's Pauly. I think that always causes a lot
of
confusion.
Yeah, Pauly is, there was a Flying Tigers Pauly, and that's a different guy. I'm talking about, no, Pauly, there's two spellings of Pauly. There's P-A-W-L-E-Y, that was the Flying Tigers. Then there's Pauly, Edwin Pauly, P-A-U-L-E-Y, and that was the head of California Standard Oil.
Now, but who then was the head of CPS? Do you,
that's Paley.
Paley, okay, fine.
Yeah,
it's Paley and Pauly. Okay.
Samuel S. Paley.
Okay, fine.
And he's listed four times in DeMarchal's phone book.
Okay.
And he admitted working with the CIA in the mid-50s, right when he's entered in DeMarchal's phone book.
Okay, fine. So the plot, as they say, the plot thickens or the plot sickens, preferring which way you prefer to have it. And, of course, here we see all of these people, so many of them tied into the CIA. And people have forgotten that our president's father was with the CIA for years. He was the director of the CIA in the mid-1970s. And then, of course, he's a member of the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderbergers, the Council on Foreign Relations. He resigns from all of these, and he runs and becomes elected vice president of the United States, where he really runs the Reagan administration. He himself becomes the president in 1989.
Ties to Ronald Reagan's almost assassin.
In fact, wasn't the assassin really the son of one of Bush's closest friends?
Yeah, Hinckley. And if you look at the unauthorized biography of George Bush, you'll see that George W. Bush admits attending parties with John Hinckley prior to the shooting of Ronald Reagan. I mean, this is George W. Bush. He says, I was at parties with him. And then right after the shooting of Ronald Reagan, Neil Mallon and John Hinckley's brother had scheduled a dinner engagement.
Now that's the father.
The brothers of
Of
George W. and the brother of John Hinckley.
Okay, fine. So I am in.
I've been tempted to send him a copy of the 1,000 Points of Light if I could only get it through the prison system.
Okay. Well, of course, the question is, everybody says he was crazy, but had his mind been programmed by some sort of an MK-Ultra program, and they do this sort of thing all the time.
I'm not an expert on Hinckley, but there was a Lewis Sprouser who wrote a great little piece on that.
Okay, fine. Well, I telephone. We've got a few more minutes with Bruce. If you'd like to give us a call, his number is 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Our guest is Bruce Adamson. He's written all sorts of books, 13 or 14 now. And if you'd like to get to them, you can give us a call at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, or you can certainly go to his website, which is CIAJFK.com. And let's see who we have. We've got Mike calling. Is this a different Mike?
Yeah, different Mike.
Okay, Mike, glad to have you with us.
The guest was talking about how he checked out people's bloodlines and whatnot, and I was wondering if he checked out JFK's and found anything strange in his line.
No, because I'm sure somebody has already done the research, but I know that grandfather was mayor of Boston, Fitzgerald.
I was thinking farther back to the, even back to Ireland.
No, I have, I was raised by one of the founding members of the Ireland American Society, Irene Kennedy, and she met President Kennedy, and her sister was a secretary, Patsy Kennedy was a secretary of Ali Khan.
Uh-huh.
And I think that was Pakistan, I'm not sure, I'm trying to remember back. But Irene Kennedy worked for Tim Hutton, Jim Hutton, Zsa Zsa Gabor, and she's really a fun lady.
But that's not Bruce's field of expertise. He's the expert on DeMarchal.
DeMarchal, yeah. But I'm always open to look. But I don't know of anything. You know,
well,
do you know something?
No. Well, and I'm not as knowledgeable. I don't study as much like as you do. But
no, I just study DeMarchal like Stan said. I'm not an expert on the Kennedys. I don't really, my sympathies don't lie for the Kennedys. I have more sympathy for the person that they put the this assassination on, the Oswald family.
Yeah.
I think if that was your family, you would want somebody to come forward and point all these mistakes out. And I mean, if it was my family, I would wouldn't want to be shamed and ridiculed as if, you know, I was John Wilkes Booth or something like that, when really I didn't have nothing to do with it.
In
right.
fact, I think the Marina eventually came to realize that Lee was actually a CIA asset. And, of course, there's so much evidence in that direction. Anyway, anything else, Mike?
No, that was it.
Okay, fine. Well, thanks
Mike.
For listening.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well,
You know, you can always give away one of those George Ely books and mention that it was edited by friends of George and Barbara Bush, and they sponsored one of my books. So that would be if you Mike wants to call back and you want to give him a free copy, you have my permission. That was on our relative who was secretary of the New York Stock Exchange for 45 years.
All right. If Mike would like one of Bruce's books free of charge, why, give us a call and here at the station, 464-8295, and we'll be glad to give him a free copy of one of Bruce's genealogical books. It doesn't deal with the Mordenschild, but it deals with, was that one of your relatives?
Yeah, he was, but it was edited by friends of George and Barbara Bush. My cousin was chairman of the Republican Party of Houston in 1969, and he helped me get into the do research on the Mordenschild into the Houston Oil Club, and he just passed away in March, and they had a memorial this past weekend for him, and that was William Hawkins, and he was a really nice guy. You know, he just received a Silver Star as a World War II pilot, and just a real nice guy. And you know, he sponsored my very first book, and I wouldn't have gone as far as I had it not been for somebody like that, who is wiser and older than me, and he edited it and put up the money, and as did George W. Ely of Lafayette. He helped sponsor the book too.
Okay, fine. Well, thanks very much, Bruce, for
and the stock market has kind of been a subject nowadays.
Okay, well, it sure is. Anyway, thank you so much for being with us this evening. It's always a pleasure having you here.
Thanks, Dan.
Bye-bye. God bless you. Okay, that was Bruce Adamson, and he's certainly has great books on the Des Moines Shelf and all various aspects of it. So if you'd like to find out how to get them, you could always call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR or go to the Internet and look up, of course, CIAJFK.com. So, of course, well, this is the time when we have to remind you that you should be praying for America. Because if we don't turn back to God, why, God is going to turn his back on the American people. And then, of course, we ask you to pray for our leaders and our ministers. We ask you to pray for my ministry, for our provision and our protection. And so until next Monday at the same time, Dr. Stan, goodbye, and may the Lord be with you.